You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks. Darren is coming back and joining us. And he is going to educate us even further on the world of John Waters. That's right. The ones he talked to us about last time weren't enough. He's coming back to talk us about polyester, about Hairspray, about Crybaby, some now classics by John Waters, and some very well-known music, very well-known movies with some more mainstream celebrities. And it's actually really interesting to see, you know, how this came about. And Darren is going to talk all about that tonight. But before we do that, we have a great show planned for you. And we are going to be, you know, joined, of course, by my co-host, my compatriarch, Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
I'm being nice to you this week. You could tell.
Yeah, that's a refreshing change.
Well, you know, I decided to give you a little bit of a break. It's mid-September, and, you know, you can feel Christmas in the air. It's time for new beginnings. Yeah, that's it.
Sure. It won't last. People, no. It won't last.
I know. We'll get you back up and running, and we'll make you pay for it later. It's okay.
Oh, yeah.
How are you, my friend?
I'm good. You know, I feel like I'm still in recovery mode from Dragon Con. But that's going to be the case for probably for the rest of the year. But everything is okay. Had a great weekend, so.
Just in time for the Dragon Con report to start up again.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Oh, understandable. And it's interesting because we're, you know, excited about what we experienced. And we have, like we keep on saying, folks, we have a lot of things going to be happening over the next couple of months with ESO, and we'll be talking to you all about it. And, you know, we're slowly making some changes to the network. We're making changes to their website. We're making changes of ways you can hear our podcast. So we've got a lot of things happening, and we'll be revealing a lot of it slowly but surely, but you'll be noticing it too. So we definitely want you guys involved with all the steps of the way. Of course, one of the ways you can help, you know, help us out, write us, please, esopodcast@gmail.com, or call us at 404-963-9057. You know, the show, of course, is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon link. That's right. No more store, folks. That's bye-bye. We are now just fully supported by Amazon itself. And if you go to esopodcast.com/ESO Amazon, or go to our website and click on the Amazon link right at the top, you can help support the station, bookmark the link, and any kind of shopping. It is never too early to start getting your pumpkin spice lattes and pumpkin spice everything. And, you know, even shopping for Thanksgiving, dare we say it? Or Halloween. Oh my God, can't forget about that. We have all these different things coming up, and do all your shopping there. I know Wonder Woman's coming out on video this week. You know, God, I sound old. It's coming out on video this week, kids. That's right. It's coming out on Blu-ray, streaming, and other ways. And yes, you can help support the station by ordering it. So it's pretty darn awesome. I think for most of us, that was one of our favorite movies of the year. And I know we talked all about it last week when we did our summer movie wrap-up. But let's get started with this week's Rants and Raves, where we talk about what's on our minds this week. And we've actually had quite a few deaths in the geek community. So we're going to go through it fairly quickly, but, you know, we'll touch on some of them. Some, if we miss, you know, we're sorry. It's just been crazy. I think, first off, I think we need to start with Harry Dean Stanton.
Okay. There's been a number of people that have left us over the last few weeks since we've been sort of busy doing all this other stuff. And yeah, to remember these people in particular is important. Not that they'll be forgotten, a lot of these people, like Harry Dean Stanton. And there's a guy who, you know, a great versatile actor. He could play a jerk. He could play a nice guy. He could play a heel. He could play, you know, the guy who knows everything. He had an extreme amount of talent, and he always it wasn't until his passing and I was really looking at like a lot of the stuff that he'd done that I realized that not only was he great in everything that he was in, he made everything that he was in better. Like even if the movie sucked, you didn't say Harry Dean Stanton sucked in that movie. He was always really good and giving it his all, but sometimes, you know, that wasn't enough. But so not only was he really good in everything that he did, but I honestly feel that he made everybody who worked with him better. Usually when I think about him, I don't think about him acting in like a lot of scenes by himself. You know, certainly not the lead role. He was always there supporting other actors and working with other actors and making them better. Whether it was with Emilio Estevez in Repo Man, or Yaphet Kotto in Alien, or Molly Ringwald in Pretty in Pink, or, you know, pick a movie and look at the scenes that he's in with other people. And he's just those people are giving performances that are outstanding as well, because he's in the moment with them. And that's rare. I mean, there's a lot of guys who go on and, you know, do their thing, but to really interact with other actors and bring out the best in everybody, that's why he got so many good roles, and that's why so many great directors wanted to work with him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was watching a movie over the weekend and I had completely forgotten he was in it. And I was watching Escape from New York.
Oh, I love that movie.
And it was like, oh, wait, there's Harry Dean Stanton. Or we're watching Twin Peaks currently. And that's a whole different story on itself, folks. And basically, Harry Dean Stanton was in that. He was in a show that Judy used to watch called Big Love. And he was one of the bad guys in that one. And he was awesome in the role. And it's funny, when I was reading his obituary and they said he was 91 years old, and it was just like, wow, I thought he was older.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Twin Peaks, The Return, and I was watching that as well. And when he would pop up, I was like, whoa, is this a case where they're making him look worse than, you know, older than he really is? Because I was like, man, he looks like he's already got one foot in the grave, so to speak. But he still didn't give a bad performance, and he still was like interesting to watch. And unfortunately, I think that's just, you know, how he was. So, look, David Lynch does a lot of stuff, but one thing he doesn't do is really, you know, mask the actors. He lets them, you know, be themselves or be the character. And, you know, Harry was great. There's like, if David Lynch and John Hughes and Ridley Scott and all these great directors want to work with you, then, you know, you must be doing something right. John Carpenter, the list goes on. You must be doing something right. And for years, decades, almost as long as I've been alive, I think he was making movies.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's just amazing, because he had one of those faces, I hate to say it, he was ageless. Because not ageless like he was a young looking man.
I was going to say, I'm like, yeah, he was pretty aged.
But he constantly, even in Escape from New York or Pretty in Pink or one of the others that we mentioned, he always looked like he was an elderly gentleman. And it was just always, he had like that kind of face where he's had a life already. And, you know, he's lived life to the hardest. And it just always was that kind of role. And seeing him like that, and then, you know, seeing him in all these roles, he kept on popping up. And he was still working on other projects when he passed away.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, he was working up to the end.
Right. And so, you know, he died of natural causes at 91. You know, very good life. I know you had one that you wanted to talk about from the horsing, actually, industry.
Well, yeah, just real quick. I mean, obviously, a lot of geeks might not recognize this name, but at least in this household, Penny Chenery was a pretty big name for us. You know, Michelle really is all about horse racing, and in particular, Secretariat. And Penny Chenery was the owner of Secretariat, and a large one of the reasons why Secretariat had the run that he did. And she did a lot. And she was a pretty interesting character. In fact, you know, the movie Secretariat really is more of a movie about Penny Chenery, played by the wonderful Diane Lane. And I've been fortunate that because of a couple of events that Michelle and I've been to, I've been in the same room with Penny Chenery, and she was just a wonderful woman. And yeah, she passed away at 95, so she lived a pretty full life. And she was just doing some appearances just a month ago. So I'm glad to see that she wasn't suffering very long and in pain. It seemed like it was pretty much a quick turn for her. So, yeah. So, but yeah. And so as far as, you know, horse racing goes in that realm, she's a pretty big name.
Yep. Very much so. And I saw the movie and it was a wonderful, wonderful film. And, you know, I'm sure you felt fortunate enough to meet her, and she, if she's half the woman that, you know, they portrayed in the movie, wow. So that's pretty awesome.
Absolutely. So, and yeah. And speaking of people that, I've been in the same room with that passed away recently, especially, thinking that, you know, Dragon Con was just right around the corner last year. Basil Gogos was at Dragon Con last year, and I remember seeing him there as well. I've never actually met him and talked to him, but I am an extreme admirer of his work. The monster movie art of his alone is so influential and so iconic. I think you'd have to be, I don't even know. If you're a fan of horror, you've seen his work.
Oh, very much so. You've definitely seen his artwork. It was all over a lot of the classic, you know, films, you know, too much to actually be numerous to talk about.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to talk more about him. Mark Maddox and I have already decided that one of our topics for next month, our countdown to Halloween episodes, will be on great horror cover artists. And of course, the spotlight will be huge on Basil, because you can't talk about magazine covers and artwork, horror artwork, without talking about Basil. So we will definitely be talking a lot more about him next month.
Oh, very much so. You have a lot of plans already for the Halloween episode, so we'll definitely be touching on that. Last but not least, this man was a legend in many different ways. And for me, he was the first manager that I ever experienced in wrestling. We're talking, of course, about Bobby the Brain Heenan. A lot of people are like, oh, wrestling. And no, Bobby transcended that. He was above all that. Bobby was a true champion for wrestling. I don't know, was he ever a wrestler?
You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to someone about this today. I don't really know the early years of how he started and got in the business. And apparently the WWE Network has a wonderful documentary on him, which now I definitely have to see. But yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that, because for me, Bobby is the brain, the mouth, the promoter, the manager, the everything, like, that isn't, he's not an actual wrestler, but he's as important to pro wrestling as anybody else that you could think of.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He is what he actually made, you know, basically how they said it, Rowdy Piper started Hulkamania, but Bobby the Brain Heenan, you know, lit the fire and continued it. Because of Bobby Heenan, you know, wrestling continued and grew through the rock and wrestling era all the way into the early 90s. And, you know, he went from being a manager to becoming an announcer, classic announcer with Gorilla Monsoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for, you know, WWF actually was the era that he was in. And the two of them, when you saw that they were going to be the announcing team, you knew you were in for a special event.
Yeah, and he was, I mean, he was outstanding in doing his job, which was to put wrestlers over. Whether it was, even when he was a manager, whether it was the guy that was he was managing or the opponent, he put them over in a way that still people just don't get.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He was just amazing. And he, you know, he managed some really classic wrestlers. You know, one of the things I remember dramatically with him, of course, you know, Andre the Giant, when mm-hmm. Andre turned heel. But for me, the classic was when Ric Flair came to the WWF for the first time and him holding the belt for Flair.
Mm.
And that just was like, wow, that was a big one, and him managing Ric Flair. And it was, he was awesome. You know, you had other great managers, but, you know, if they ever did, you know, basically a statue or, you know, a series of, you know, statues like a Mount Rushmore of wrestling managers, I think Bobby Heenan would have to be the first one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's already in the Hall of Fame. But so, I mean, yeah, that says it all, but I mean, his impact is huge.
Exactly. And that's the great thing about him. He's, you know, he is, you know, when you see someone now like, Paulie Dangerously or, you know, or Paul Heyman as he's known now, or you see some of the other managers, they have Bobby Heenan to thank for all that. He paved the way for that. There were managers before him. You know, there was Lou Albano. There was the Swami. There was, you know, even Mr. Fuji and stuff. But you don't really think about them from that era. You think of Bobby the Brain Heenan or Jimmy Hart. So you have, you know, those kind of people who were, you know, made, you know, as a kid, they made wrestling entertaining for me. They were almost sometimes more fun than the wrestlers themselves.
Yeah. Well, that's because he sold the wrestlers. I mean, the wrestlers were doing what they were doing in the ring, but he was telling you why they were doing it. And he was telling you why you should like this person or why you should hate them. Or even if he was like the way he would tell you things that you would hate a guy just because, even if he liked the guy, like you would hate him because of the way Bobby was presenting it. It's just, he was so skilled with the microphone and his words that, you know, he could really have you in the palm of his hand.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's what the great thing about it is he, you know, he molded what he wanted to come out of it. And that was the best part about it. You know, all the different wrestlers, you know, and it was just great because sometimes he did all the talking for the wrestlers when you had a talent who wasn't that great on the microphone. Or if you had a wrestler who, you know, was really good and mic savvy, he just started it and then the wrestler would take over and he would let them be, but he would goose them on. And so that's pretty darn awesome. And, you know, lately when I've seen him the last couple times, he has not been in good health for many, many years.
Yeah, he's been suffering for a while. So,
yeah. And so he passed away at 71 this past weekend. And, you know, Godspeed to all these people. Wow. All right. Let's go on to more positive things. Let's, you know, we'll bring Darren in here. He'll lighten the mood. He always does. But we want to hear from you guys. ESOpodcast@gmail.com. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment with John Waters.
Hi, This is Ashley Pauls with Box Office Buzz, here to talk about the latest movies coming out this week. I am really excited because we are finally in fall movie season. It feels like it's been a really long month. There hasn't been a whole lot out at the box office the past couple of weeks, but the good news is some of the fall movies we're all looking forward to are finally on their way. And one of those is Kingsman: The Golden Circle. This is a follow-up to the first Kingsman movie, The Secret Service. I really enjoyed the first Kingsman. I thought it was a fun, over-the-top spy comedy with a healthy dose of British wit. It's definitely not a movie for everyone. Like I said, it's pretty over-the-top, but it was a lot of fun, and I think the sequel is going to be fun, too. Sometimes it's tough to recapture the magic in the second movie, but I love that they're bringing in the American statesmen to fight alongside the British kingsmen, so I think there'll be enough new material here to keep it fresh, and hopefully some of that same trademark over-the-top action that I loved about the first one. If you're looking for a movie to take your kids to this weekend, you might want to try the Lego Ninjago movie. I don't know a whole lot about this property personally, other than that it apparently involves Lego Ninja Warriors. But I love the Lego movie, so this one might be worth checking out. I don't think this one will be as big of a breakout hit as the Lego movie, just because the property is a little more specialized and maybe not as well known to a broader audience like the Lego Batman movie. But the trailers looked kind of funny, so I'm hopeful that there'll be some jokes that'll keep the adults entertained as well as the kids in the audience. For other movies in theaters, we have the horror film Friend Request, about a girl who gets into danger on Facebook. And then the true life dramatization Battle of the Sexes, about the famous tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. This one stars Emma Stone and Steve Carell, and it looks pretty good too. Out on DVD this week, I'm really excited that Wonder Woman is finally coming out. I pre-ordered it and can't wait for it to come. Keep checking the mailbox every day. Wonder Woman was a really nice surprise this summer. I had been a little worried about it based on some of DC's other cinematic universe films, but I thought Wonder Woman was a really strong step forward, had an empowering hero, a great story. I'm just super excited for how well it did at the theater, so I'm hoping that it's a sign of more good things to come for DC. And, of course, I'll be watching it many more times when it comes on DVD. We also have Arrow Season 5 coming to home video. If you aren't caught up on the CW superhero show, definitely now is a good time. Season 5 was excellent, put the show back on a firmer footing. And Season 6 is getting ready to come out pretty soon, so now is a great time to get caught up. Well, that's it for this week. If you're looking for more entertainment-related content, check out my blog at boxofficebuzzab.wordpress.com.
My name is Brian Foster.
Everything you know is wrong. Got that?
Now, the reason that I'm calling is because I have begun to suspect you don't have any ladybugs in your freezer.
Hey, cuz, Roy here. So about your car.
The darkness was never empty.
There's this presence in my head.
But I'm pretty sure that the book was confiscated by cats.
You're damn right we find a lot of bodies when Foster is around.
And some people call me the Night Blogger.
Me down. It's like a message from high above. Oh, oh. everybody. Welcome to the fun part of the show. We're going to talk more about that Pope of Trash, Mr. John Waters, and the movies that he made. This is like his middle section. Of course, he's made a lot of movies, so we're just taking a few. But as far as the three that mean the most in his middle career, I'm picking up Polyester, Hairspray, and Crybaby. You might be, well, I've heard of Hairspray sounds really familiar, and it probably does because Hairspray is one of his most popular movies to hit the mainstream. But we're going to start with Polyester because Polyester came out first. And Polyester came out in 1981, and it's more or less a parody of what we would call a Lifetime movie of the abused housewife who then gets her act together and comes out the other side smelling like a rose. And, of course, the housewife is Francine Fishpaw, played by Divine, of course. The titular, literally, Divine. And in this movie, she is married to a porn theater owner who is having an affair with his secretary, who's played by another John Waters standby, Mink Stoll, because you got to fit all those folks from his crazy players in there. They have two children. One is Lulu, who is the high school slut, basically. And the other one is, where are my notes? Dexter, I think. Dexter is a foot fetishist and has been kicked out of school for truancy because they think he's a danger to the community. And, of course, we can't have a John Waters film at this point without Edith Massey. And Edith Massey plays Cuddles, who used to be Francine's cleaning lady, but now she has inherited a lot of money and now she's very well-to-do, much more well-to-do than Francine. And she is actually Baltimore's oldest living debutante now. Things go downhill for Francine quite dramatically after the son gets put into juvie. The daughter gets knocked up by her boyfriend and she finds her husband with the secretary at a don't-tell motel. Francine eventually files for divorce, and she runs across Tab Hunter's character. And Tab Hunter, for those of you who don't know, was a big teen heartthrob, I believe in the 50s and 60s. But at this point, his career had kind of been on the wane. And he plays Todd Tomorrow. That sounds like a made-up name, doesn't it? Well, Todd Tomorrow woos Francine, and they have a great time until Francine finds out that Todd Tomorrow and his hot chippy on the side were just conspiring to steal Francine's divorce settlement from her husband, Elmer. Did I mention Todd has a drive-in business where he plays art films? Francine's got a very specific type of man that she goes after, and they are porn fetish men, apparently. The two, Todd and his chippy, get into the house late at night to kill Francine, and the kids, having converted from their harlot and crazy ways, come into the house, and they kill the two who are invading, and then they live happily ever after, woohoo.
Well, there you go.
That's basically it. So, and of course, Cuddles becomes a member of the family. So they kind of live off of Cuddles' inheritance, which is fine because Cuddles likes Francine. Yay! This is one of those things where it's like, we're going to turn Americana on its side again. Where have you noticed in John Waters films, the couples are always the bad people? It's always the married couples that are always bad people. It's kind of
amusing. Stop looking at me, Darren.
I'm looking at you.
Oh, do you want to introduce that Michael's joining us tonight?
Oh, yeah, Michael's here. Everybody, say hi to Michael. I'm a Darren with three Michaels. There's a Mike and a Mike and a Michael. You can tell which one's gay because he's the Michael.
Of course.
It's like there are Daves and then there are Davids.
Hey, wait a minute.
We have a problem with Paul, though. Pauls could be anything.
And frequently are.
Exactly. Look at the one you do a co-host with on that other podcast.
I know. He worries me. I know. Really worries me.
So let me ask you, what would you say, like, why is Polyester not considered part of the, well, obviously, you know, trilogy is three, but yeah. So you have the Trash trilogy. What makes Polyester separate from those films?
It's separate because it's not as gross. It has a gimmick of course, and we're going to get to that. But it's not Divine picking up dog crap and eating it. It's not at that level. You know what I mean? I think at this point, John Waters realizes you can only make pink flamingos so many times.
Gotcha.
So he's got to do something different to get people in. And so his gimmick, and of course he was inspired by the movie makers of old that would have the gimmicks in the theater that you would come in and like the tingler, woo, which would just be a small electric jolt underneath your chair. This movie came with the Odorama card. And And when you got to a part of the film and a number would pop up, you were supposed to scratch and sniff that part of the card to smell what the characters were smelling. And they actually, like, the characters would be like, you know, they would be deep inhaling. So you get the idea, oh, you're supposed to smell this. And it had 10 different smells on it. Number one was roses. Number two was a fart. Number three was model airplane glue for you huffers in the audience. Number four was pizza. Number five was gasoline. Number six was a skunk. Number seven was natural gas. Number eight was new car smell. Number nine was dirty shoes. And number 10 was air freshener.
Whereas I remember Odorama from Rugrats. And exactly. It was very different smells with strawberry and peanut butter and stinky foot. And like there was like six of them.
Mm-hmm. And John Waters and Paramount had a little bit of legal battle because they never got a clearance from him to use the word Odorama for their movie, The Rugrats.
I see.
So, yeah.
Well, this was the Wikipedia hole that you started me in today. I looked all that up. And the cinema had allowed the patent to expire. So that's why I was allowed to continue.
Well,
For a couple movies. So, but yeah, and I blame Darren for a good 30 or 45 minutes of a Wikipedia hole today for lots of stuff on these movies.
You're welcome. Now, is this something that only happened in the theatrical release, or can you recreate that in the DVD or home video release?
The DVDs that were released for Polyester included Odorama cards.
Goodness. Okay. So have you experienced the Odorama cards?
I have not, sir. Okay. I have willfully gone past that. Live long enough with Michael, you're going to smell those smells anyway. So.
Wow, you knew that was coming.
Yep. Oh, I know.
Well, it was interesting because this was the first John Waters movie that actually used a big name star.
Yeah, Tab Henner. It was the first big name that John Waters got.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And because, you know, before he had his motley crew, which included mm-hmm. Divine and others, but
Divine
this,
and Mink Soul and
exactly. Massey. Exactly. But this one actually, you know, when he went out and actually got folks from Hollywood, and it was just like Tab Hunter, you know, he hadn't been in anything really huge for probably 20 years at this point, mm-hmm. but he still was a name.
True. And we should say that Edith Massey passed away in 1984 from diabetes and lymphoma. And I believe Divine Waters was her last movie in 1985. She did like three after this one. Hmm. So, yeah.
Gotcha.
So she passed away after 84, 85. So she would not be around when we are discussing our next film.
Mm-hmm. Is it also fair to say, though, another difference and maybe the reason, another reason that this is separate, is it there's a not commercial or mainstream, but there's a more of a story and a plot in this one?
There is more of a story and a plot, and it's a little stronger structure than other movies that he made. But he was no longer doing that guerrilla filmmaking that he was doing.
Right. Yeah. This is. So
he actually has money. He's got some backing now, and he can actually do a real film. Now the sets are kind of awful.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's stripped down funding, but it's still there.
Yeah.
You know, John Waters is still there. I think the next movie is where we really get into, oh, okay, he can do something else with money. So.
Yeah, well, I think this one also, you know, shows at least Hollywood that he can, not that he can be contained, but that he can play with real toys.
Yeah, and he can edit like, himself.
And even though he's a guerrilla filmmaker or has a reputation of it, he still can adhere to a budget and do the things necessary that a professional can do.
Totally.
No, well, to me, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Michael.
This one for me, I was playing it in the background while I was working. This one had that you can tell that the changes that are taking effect. There were so many good one-liners in this movie. It made me think of Blazing Saddles and the things you just had fun with then that you probably couldn't get away with right now unless you're doing like as a college production to put it up online for free. And it was so, yeah, it wasn't over the top like with Pink Flamingos, but it was something that was still entertaining as all hell. And you could turn and like pause it and go back and go, what'd they really just do right then? But there is that edge to it that was like that fun edge rather than crazy edge.
Yeah, it definitely has the gay wit about it for sure.
No, that's actually very true. And the humor really came out in this one. You didn't have all the grossisms like you did in the earlier stuff. And you felt like this was going somewhere.
Yeah, this it was actually more of a traditional camp movie.
Yes.
Yeah, this is more witty than gross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you actually start seeing the John Werder's mark with the humor he always captured from pretty much this film on. And, you know, I really felt like this was, you know, a real turning point for him.
Yeah, well, at this point, he's got the attention of America.
Right.
Everyone knows, oh, he did Pink Flamingos?
Yeah.
So they're going to go see it based on that.
That's a good way to put it. But it also, for him, it was a neat experience because, you know, we talked a little bit, but, you know, from this point on, you get to know John Waters because he pops up in every one of his films.
Yeah, totally.
So, and that was always one of his trademarks, and he had a pretty fairly decent size role in this one. And the next two we're going to talk about later in this segment also has, you know, John Waters, you know, playing fairly substantial roles also.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yes.
Just a wee little bit.
We'll talk all about that. But
it's all Baltimore, right?
Oh, it is. It is all Baltimore.
It's all Baltimore.
Exactly. And that's the great part about it. And I can't wait to, William, I haven't shown any of the John Waters movies to yet. And he watched Hairspray when they did the musical version of it on NBC, I think it was.
Okay, so the live version.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't seen the movie yet.
Gotcha.
So, but we'll get into that in a few minutes.
Indeed. We could get into it now if you want to.
I was going to say, I think we should get into it now.
Move okay.
Over. Why All wait?
Well, Hairspray comes next in what we are looking at. It is by far his most popular film. It's his most mainstream film. It might be kind of a misnomer to put those both together. Many people love his early stuff because it is gross. But Hairspray is the one that was the commercial success in his career. It is the first John Waters film that was PG, which that's subversive. Yeah, yeah. The guy who made a drag queen eat dog shit is doing a PG movie. What? It is the last film before Divine, also known as Harris Glenn Milstead, would pass away. Hairspray was released on February 26, 1988, and Divine passed away March 7th, 1988, of a combination of heart attack brought on by sleep apnea.
Wow.
So he had a week and a half of fame. Aww. Now, Divine had quite a substantial career in underground and in disco, you know, in the 70s and such, but this was like the breakout moment for Divine. And he only got to experience a week and a half of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the film that introduced America to Ricky Lake. Remember her?
Oh, yeah.
The talk show host
and China Beach and a couple of other things.
And many other things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The original Hairspray movie would spawn a Broadway musical and a movie musical of the Broadway musical and a live TV musical of the musical.
Yep,
John Travolta in drag.
Oh, that's frightening. Mm-hmm. To quote Lady Bunny, did you hear about that new movie called Travolta? It's never coming out.
Well, it was interesting because Divine actually had two roles in Hairspray.
Yes,
because mm-hmm. you got to see him as a straight,
as a straight guy.
Yeah,
and the movie also got a lot more star power with Debbie Harry, Rick Ocasek, and Ruth Brown from the music world, as well as I don't count Sonny Bono as from the music world.
I was going to say, yeah.
Well. I don't really count him. It was Cher, let's be honest.
Wow.
Jerry Stiller, Pia Zadora, and Sean Thompson. So these were kind of names back then. They were cult names for the most part, but they were still named people who had careers before coming to be a part of this movie. This movie starts off in Baltimore in the year 1962, where Tracy Turnblad and her best friend Penny Pingleton are want to be part of the Corny Collins show. And it's like American Bandstand, but local. So they have all these kids who are part of the in crowd. And of course, they have to audition because one of the girls got pregnant and has to leave the show for about 9 months. Who knew? So they go to the audition, and it's Tracy, Penny, and Nadine, who is an African-American woman. And of course, they don't see Nadine past the quick dancing because she can't dance any day except for quote unquote Negro Day, because this is before segregation and integration happened. I mean, integration happened, right? So they only had one day of the week where, or one day of the month where they would let Motor Mouth Mama Maybelle come on, and she would do all of the quote unquote Negro music and be all black cast dancing for the Corny Collins show instead. And of course, Tracy, being a liberal gal of some size, she is a larger figured gal, thinks this is wrong. And her mom is played by Divine, of course, because who else could play Tracy Turnblad's mom but Divine?
But then also, well, who was her dad?
Her dad was Jerry Stiller.
Mm-hmm. It was awesome.
Little, itty bitty short Jerry Stiller, which was hilarious. And they would carry that through Hairspray in each iteration, that Edna was always larger than I forget the name of the guy who is the husband, but Mr. Turnblad, we'll just call him that. Of course, Tracy has to have a nemesis, right? And it's Amber Von Tussle. Just the name makes you want to go, ooh. Amber is got to be like the first at everything. And she is kind of seeing Link Larkin, who is the heartthrob of the show. And her mom and dad own Tilted Acres Amusement Park. And mom and dad are Sonny Bono and Debbie Harry. Now, what's interesting is Velma Von Tussle makes it to the musical, but poor Franklin Von Tussle's character is erased from memory after this movie. I guess they wanted one villain, and so, or two villains, so they got Velma and Amber to be the villains in Hairspray after this. Tracy teases her hair up. She's a hair hopper. And so this poor little kid behind her can't see in class. So she gets sent to detention. And this is where, well, she actually gets sent to special ed because she can't comb her hair correctly. And this is where they get to meet Seaweed and all of his friends, because all the black kids are in special education in Baltimore public schools. And so they meet, and Penny falls in love with Seaweed. Penny has a very controlling mother who wants to tie her down and do all kinds of things to her because she's obviously misbehaving every minute of the day. They eventually get over to Motormouth Maybelle's record store. They have an impromptu kind of dance thing. Tracy and Link have kind of hooked up because Amber got kicked off the show temporarily. And, well, things evolve from there, to which point Tracy is actually arrested at a rally for integration along with a few other people. And there's a race riot at Tilted Acres. Good times, right? And so Motormouth Maybelle gets the governor to sign a pardon for Tracy Turnblad. Amber has been doing her best to get the crown. I forget what the name of the stupid competition is. The Hairspray Queen crown, basically. And they have a dance off. And so Amber dances to the roach and dedicates it to Tracy Turnblad. Tracy shows up in a dress with roaches embroidered on it and dances for everybody. Tracy wins. Amber doesn't get that. And everybody gets to dance and the show becomes integrated. Woohoo! That's how you solve a race war.
Mm-hmm. John Waters. Well, wasn't it part of it was that they were saying that Tracy had the roaches in her hair?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, oh, yeah, that's how they were. That's what the whole thing started with, the roaches. And because she was making up all these nasty rumors about Tracy Turnblad.
She's a whore. Exactly. Like that was like, that line was like the best line, because it's like, that is every poor girl's insult in high school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're a whore.
You're a whore. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. They run into Piazzadora and Rico Kasich as pot smoking beatniks, which are pretty hilarious.
They were awesome.
They were very awesome. They were great. Pia Zadora gets a lot of crap, but I loved her in this role. It's very cute.
There was a lot to like about this movie, and it's one of part, you know, it's my favorite one that comes in my John Waters collection that comes out all the time. Because also the music in it is just wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, because it doesn't have like a lot of the numbers like Good Morning Baltimore and the singing and stuff like that from the musical. Mm-hmm. But it has just a lot. It has
the songs of the day.
Well, exactly. It has the 1963 music, both, you know, a lot of well-known stuff, but a lot of stuff that was just known in Maryland and stuff. Mm-hmm. That this is the stuff that John Waters was listening to growing up. And that's what was great about this movie. Mm-hmm. And it captured the feel. And I think he did a great job of it too.
Oh, I think it was an excellent movie. Mm-hmm. I loved Hairspray.
It's definitely, I mean, career wise for him, it's a peak, right?
Oh yeah.
Probably might be the peak, which is not to say that he's not creative going forward, but after this, but it's as far as, yeah, everything like lightning striking all at the right time, the planets being aligned and any other, you know, cliche you want to use. I mean, that everything was like right there for him. And I got to give him credit. I mean, this is his first. Yeah. I mean, it shows that his love, that he has a love for film that's just beyond, you know, guerrilla filmmaking. Like, yeah, this shows that he loved, you know, his love for musicals, his love for like all that stuff in the 50s and 60s. It shows that he can make a mainstream movie with subversive elements that are not necessarily like in your face, but yet still be effective. I mean, his hand is really deft here, you know, as far as what it's doing. And I think that surprised a lot of people as well. I mean, like they knew that John Waters was a great filmmaker because he was like, you know, bold, but I don't think they knew this movie showed that he's a great filmmaker because he knows how to make a great film.
Exactly. I mean, it's very well structured.
Yep.
Lots of great music. In fact, Ricky Lake talks about how they kept feeding her Dove bars during the production because she was losing weight because they were dancing.
Oh, right.
Like 20 sometimes hours a day. So between takes, she was eating Dove bars.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They couldn't have Tracy lose weight.
Huh. No, because she was supposed to remain heavy. And
yeah,
Ricky was Ricky was naturally heavy before this. And that's afterwards, that's when she started taking the weight off and became the Ricky Lake that we knew later. But it was interesting. And I loved how John Waters played the exorcist trying to exorcise
Penny Pingleton.
Exactly.
Oh, that was hilarious. It made me think of like a skinned down version of the Penguin twirling the umbrella at her. Yes. And all that.
What's it supposed to do? Just give you a splitting headache. And of course, Mink Stole is actually in this movie. She plays Tammy, the assistant of Corny Collins. And of course, her over the top is very reined in here.
Oh, very much
so. She's very business, you know, pointing to the girls with the sign that says falsies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still hilarious. It's done in a way that's not over the top crazy.
I didn't recognize her the first couple times I saw it. And it was like, why isn't she? It was like that type of thing.
She had to be very pinched in for that role.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the characters and the actors that he usually used were in this movie, but in very sedate roles.
Very, very small doses. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because you still had his misfits in it.
Oh, yeah. And of course, Divine played the head of the Hairspray Company, I believe.
I thought it was the head of the TV station.
The head of the TV station. The head of the TV station, yeah.
Yeah.
That's who Divine played as a man. Mm-hmm. So you got to see him for a minute as what he really is.
Yeah, it made me do a double take. I was not expecting to see him as a male.
Mm-mm. Yep.
Right.
You always see him as what he really was, which was Divine. So a moment for Divine. All right.
There you go. Indeed. Divine. But it's neat because you did get a really good feel of Baltimore in the 1960s at this point. Because this is still pre-Beatles, before the British Revolution. And, you know, you had a lot of innocence still.
It was just the beginning of talking about, you know, campus unrest and things like that. The beginning of the Beatnik movement and things like that are seeded through here, but they're definitely not in the mainstream or out in the light where you can see it.
No, because the Beatniks basically, you know, in this era, within the next 2 years, started becoming the hippies. Because you had like a lot of what you saw in it. You had the different cultures, and, you know, you had Motown starting at this time. You had, and that's what you saw a lot of with the black culture. And then you also saw, and you saw how segregated, even because Baltimore was considered a northern city, even, but there was still segregation.
But still segregation, yeah.
Yes. And so it was just, it was really interesting at this point. And, but you also had, you know, the folk movement going on, and he touched on it real briefly in this, but it was mostly, you know, because that's the kind of music they were playing with the Beatniks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And Reefer.
Exactly. Reefer. Of course, yeah. Reefer. Exactly. And so it was neat to see. And this movie just always puts a smile on my face whenever I watch it. It's like one of those, if it's on cable, if I'm flipping channels and I see Hairspray's on, I'll stop, you know, and yep. I'll watch it from no matter what point in the movie it's at.
And so I always tell people, if you've never seen a John Waters film and you want to start slow, Hairspray is the starting point.
Oh, yeah.
Because no one eats any dog shit. There's no nudity in Hairspray. It's a PG movie. You're not going to be shocked by anything that happens. You know, it's just a fun movie with a message, believe it or not. Shocking. You might learn something. Who knew? You know,
well, it was done.
John Waters is teaching it to you. You should be very disturbed.
Well, it was done at a lot of time, a time too, when I think, I mean, a great period of American filmmaking that I don't think gets enough credit, where the late 80s, where these sort of filmmakers, these quirky filmmakers, were really starting to really tap into what America was like, and doing like quirky things that like you had John Waters, you had David Lynch, you had Jonathan Demme, you had even, you know, a little bit like the studios were getting involved with the remake of Little Shop of Horrors. Like, there's like a lot of movies that are being made around this time that you look back and you consider they might be considered cult classics, but at the time they were much more than that. They were really inventive, and Hollywood was real. I think it was almost the last time that Hollywood was just really indulging a lot of very creative people.
Oh, extremely.
Well,
so
they needed to see what was gonna, you know, stick to the wall.
Well, exactly, because you even had Sam Raimi coming up around this time also.
Mm-hmm. And John Hughes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a lot of like really, really creative folks making movies around that time. And they were all different. They weren't just churning out, you know, I mean, I'm sure in some ways, you know, they were a lot of them were looking like a studio that made, you know, Warner Brothers had released Little Shop of Horrors, the musical. And I'm sure it did well enough that they were like, we need something else like that. And Hairspray kind of might have gotten the go-ahead because they were looking at like that going, that's kind of like that.
It's kind of a musical.
Yeah, maybe. It's kind of a musical, and it kind of is that quirkiness that people dig. So that the kids like.
Can you dig it, my brother?
But the fact that, you know, the fact that John wanted to make it, you know, like, I don't think he was strong-armed to make a PG movie. I think he generally wanted to make a movie.
No, I think he chose to make this movie.
Absolutely. Totally. That was part of the, like, I want to see what I can do with a PG movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a challenge for him.
Yeah.
But yeah,
and most of the movies that he loved were PG.
Yeah, when you get to that point where, well, I made someone eat dog shit, where do you go from there? I mean, where do you go from that point artistically and still become relevant and keep an audience? And now you have to kind of go to the fine points of the satire, right? Where you're still looking at Americana and pointing out this is a problem, but you're doing it in a way that people don't notice that you're doing it. I mean, there's a lot of things pointed out here. There's fat shaming in Hairspray, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
There's obviously the racial problems in Hairspray. There's the whole thing about controlling women in Hairspray. Poor Penny. Good Lord, the things she put up with. That'd be child abuse today.
Well, exactly.
It was allowed.
The things that were happening to her reminded me a lot of what was in the movie Carrie in some ways.
Kind of.
Yeah. You know, because
there's in the last reel. Damn.
And, you know, I mean, he just loves to work with outcasts. You know, I mean, the Pia Zadora is a perfect example of someone who, like, was an outcast. But of course, John Waters is going to be like, no, you come on with me. He'll do the same thing with Tracy Lords in the next.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Hollywood doesn't like you? Come on my set. Well, I've got a part for you.
And in Hairspray, you have an interracial couple by the end of the movie. So you want to talk about outsiders back then.
Well, exactly. Yes.
You know, that was huge.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was accepted. And that's what was great about it. You know, it was encouraged. And John Waters was trying to push that through, was like, hey, there's nothing wrong with any of this.
Exactly.
And that was the point with it.
I do want to say that there are a few other people who have played Edna. Edna is kind of the role that is the peach here, especially in the musical version. Obviously, Divine did it here in the non-musical version, but great gay uncle Harvey Firestein, kids, played Edna for years on Broadway, and she did it with a deep baritone.
Is that so wrong?
It's very wrong, darling. Very wrong.
John Travolta
did it in the musical version of the movie, and then they had Harvey do it again for the live TV version of the movie. So if you've never seen Harvey Firestein, and a lot of you have not, I suggest you watch that TV version of Hairspray, because it is a treat.
It's interesting because, you know, I got to see the play in Seattle when I was living out there, and it was Harvey being Edna, and it was awesome. And I had not heard the soundtrack before I saw it. And literally from the very first scene where it has Tracy laying in bed upright, you know, singing Good Morning Baltimore, you are hooked.
And totally. It's a great night at the theater. Totally.
Exactly. And it was just a ton of fun. And, you know, John Waters is laughing all the way to the bank with that.
Totally. Because it's still in production today, I believe.
Oh, yeah. It's still on Broadway.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Still on Broadway, still touring. Mm-hmm. And if it comes to you, you should definitely go see it. It is a fun night at the theater.
Yeah, you will not be disappointed.
Not at all. Not at all.
No. No, Ian, go on to the next one, sir.
Okay. Going on to the next one, Crybaby. This is the Drapes versus the Squares gang war movie. The Drapes are what we would call the greasers, I guess. The bad guys. Quote unquote, the bad guys, and the Squares would be the quote unquote good guys. But we're going to switch that for Crybaby, because that's not the case here. The Drapes are actually
not how John Waters rolls.
Yep. The Drapes are our heroes and the Squares are our villains. So the first thing you'll notice about this movie is you get Johnny Depp as the lead in a John Waters movie.
Was this one of his first leads?
It was his first lead movie, because he wasn't in Edward Scissorhands. Did not release for another 8 months.
Wow. And because I know this is right after 21 Jump Street. Right.
Yep. And of course, he was eaten by a mattress in Nightmare on Elm Street. So.
Well,
anything to get on a poster. Anything to get on a poster, right? more casting of quirky actors. Susan Tyrell. From Forbidden Zone. That's a classic black and white movie that we might find on this list of things you should check out soon. It stars the music of Oingo Boingo. So it's a little fun. Polly Bergen is in this movie. Iggy Pop is in this movie, as is the infamous Tracy Lords.
Mm-hmm.
The old favorite Mink Stole is back. And she is the mom of Tracy Lord's character, along with her husband, who is another ex-teen heartthrob, kind of cut from the same jib of Tab Hunter, but it's Troy Donahue. And for those of you who remember your Grease musical, Look at me, Troy Donahue, I know what you want to do, is a line Rizzo sings in Look at me, I'm Sandra Dee.
Da, 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 da,
exactly. Before you get excited... Johnny Depp and Amy Locane, who plays Allison, the leads of this movie, their voices were dubbed for the songs. They're not really singing. James Intveld sang for Crybaby's songs, and Rachel Sweet sang for Allison's songs.
I bet Depp was pissed.
Not sure.
Huh. I don't know. He just seems to me like a guy who considers himself a musician, and that he would take that very seriously.
But he was still early into his career at the time. He didn't take himself so seriously at the time.
I bet he did. Very stylized, like rockabilly sound that both of them have.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Waters plucked them because I can't do this movie without these vocals coming out of those mouths over there, because it just would sound wrong. So we are in 1954. So we've gone back 8 years. We're still in Baltimore. Shocking no one. We're in Baltimore. Wade Crybaby Walker is the leader of the Gang of Drapes, which includes his sister Pepper. Oh, look, there's Ricky Lake again, who is constantly pregnant in the movie. Like, always pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
His gang also includes Mona, who is known as Hatchet Face. Oh, good God, the things they did with makeup. Mona did not really look like that. She has since passed on, I believe. But Hatchet Face, that was a face that would stop a clock.
It would break a couple mirrors, too.
Yep. Literally, in the movie. Wanda Woodard is played by Tracy Lords. She's the sex bomb of the Crybaby gang. And Milton Hackett, who is Hatchetface's boyfriend. And Crybaby gets his nickname from being able to cry a single tear out of one eye. Isn't that hot?
Which later becomes a tattoo.
Yeah, it's very dreamy. Aww. Eventually, he meets Allison Vernon Williams, actually in line to get their vaccinations, because that's how it was done back then. So they're both together getting their shots, and Crybaby's just looking at her and crying a single tear, and she's instantly smitten, and it's over. She will be a drape soon.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically, Crybaby kind of harasses Allison and her guardian on the way back to their house via cars, you know, doing that playing chicken thing. He gets Allison to go with her to Turkey Point, which is a great place. It's like a state park, but there's not a lot of grass there.
It
looks very, very bare for a state park. There's a couple of pavilions and a picnic table or two.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare.
But a lot of different scenes take place in that, too.
Totally.
Yeah.
We get to meet Crybaby's grandparents, which is Ramona Ricketts, played by Susan Tyrell, and then Iggy Pop plays her husband. Unfortunately, when Allison goes off, her square boyfriend, Baldwin, and the rest of the squares, who, of course, they sing in a quartet, which isn't that just adorable, decide to go after them, and they have a big fight. But Allison also meets Lenora, and there's a new phrase later, Lenora, in the household, because Devin now says that a lot to people when he's done with them. Lenora wants to be Crybaby's woman, and Crybaby is having none of it. Apparently they were like together or not together, but she's like, no, go away, Lenora. Later, Lenora. And the women, you know, basically turn her out and say, no, he doesn't want to be with you. Sorry. Crybaby gets arrested eventually, of course, for being part of this huge fight and sent to a penitentiary. And then Allison tries to get his grandmother to help get Crybaby busted from jail because she knows the judge. Lenora tries to make up this fake story about how Crybaby got her pregnant, which makes Allison upset, obviously, blah, 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 blah. Eventually, they get everybody out of prison, and they go have a fight with the Drapes and the Squares, and the Drapes win, and Crybaby gets Allison in his arms, and now Crybaby can cry out of both eyes.
Oh.
Love in his heart.
Wah, wah.
It's so adorable. Now, what's fun about this movie is that it is more of a traditional musical in which you have some definite characters, and they actually sing songs. Shocking. Or they're dubbed, one of the two. Yeah, you choose. There's a lot of fun stuff in this movie. The rubber biscuit scene with Hatchetface and Milton is hilarious, where they try to spring Crybaby from the penitentiary, and then they wind up leaving in the laundry van, basically. It's pretty funny.
I could have done without the scene where Ricky Lake's character actually gave birth in the car.
While they're doing a chicken race, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, that I could have done without.
The adoption agency was horrifying, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Because, of course, Ricky Lake gets, you know, arrested and is called an unfit mother. You know, so her children are taken from her. She's got two kids and pregnant with another one coming. And, of course, they put them in these little, like department store windows in a way. We're like, oh, he'll do the vacuuming and she'll do the dishes. And then they put them together in the same outfit like it's a two-headed child. Like Siamese twins. It's very, very frightening, but they break the kids out. So, yay. And the kids can drive, which is amazing. But there's a lot of cute, fun stuff in this movie. It's not my favorite, but it's notable for Johnny Depp being in it, for one, because it's like, wow, okay. He does crawl around in a sewer in his underwear for a good 5 minutes in this movie, kids. So if that's what you're into, there you go. You found it.
I think this is the first time that Roger gets to that John Waters gets to work with one of his heroes, Patty Hearst.
Oh yeah.
And they would go on to do a bunch of other movies too, but she becomes one of his crew in this movie.
Yeah, one of the crazy cast of characters, and we'll be pointing out her involvement with John Waters in the next episode in a certain movie called Serial Mom.
Yeah, Crybaby to me was the first one that made me feel like Waters was going formulaic pop culture, and there were good parts and funny parts, but I was kind of bored by it.
Yeah,
for a musical too, the music doesn't hold up, I don't think, either. Yeah. By and large, I mean, there's some that are not bad, but overall, it's not really one that you find yourself like listening to a lot.
No, agreed. It was interesting because after how popular and how amazing Hairspray was, Crybaby was not a letdown because it was still a fun movie. Don't get me wrong. It's part of my collection, but I don't go to that one as much. It's not like a must watch and stuff. There's great parts. I love Iggy Pop, and you know, I've been a huge Iggy fan since the Stooges days, but it was neat to see him act. But then God, his voice was just like, "Hey, Elmer, how are you?" You know,
how are you?
Exactly. Like, wow. That's not how Iggy is. Iggy talks down deep like this.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And he's definitely affecting an accent in this movie.
Exactly.
I believe it's his biggest ever box office open for any of his films, because it was coming right off the tail, like obviously the tail end of Hairspray. Everybody wants to see the new movie. This one does, like, so everybody goes. And then, yeah, obviously they're not as enamored. And
by this
and one. And that continues on. I think after this one, people are like, well, we're not sure.
Well, I also think it was a choice of the protagonist too. Crybaby is meant to be this downtrodden outsider, but in reality, he's like the hero of most of the movie. You don't get to see him be an outsider much because he's already got a gang around him.
Yeah, and it's no offense to Johnny Depp.
For him, it's kind of hard to.
Yeah, it's no offense to Johnny Depp too, but he's like, you know, he's this really like stunning looking like guy that like it should be, you know, featured in his own movie. So it's not like he doesn't really feel like an outsider as much because he's, you know, he's just a pretty boy.
No, exactly.
I mean, his parents did go to the electric chair. I mean, he does tell that story, but
right. But I mean, as far as physically looking at Depp himself, not the character, but I'm not saying he was miscast because I think he did as well as he could. But with all the other, you know, with a lot of other movies, you get these characters played by people who are against type, but he's like right on type.
He is right on type. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's a lesson that Waters will learn and that he goes, well, I'm going to go against type from now on. I mean, Johnny's cool and all, but yeah.
It's definitely a look, you know. If you're going to be a hero in a John Waters film, you need to look like an outsider too.
Yeah. And as much as even Johnny Depp was at the time, like, he's kind of is an outsider, but he's not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, Johnny Depp is a handsome man, and Allison was played by a gorgeous girl.
Yes. Yes. I mean, right.
It's very Romeo and Juliet, West Side Story kind of a story here, which we've seen time and time again. So yeah. It's hard to make that interesting again.
It's almost like he's trying to recreate, Travolta and Olivia Newton-John from Grease here.
Kind of.
And then spin it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He took Grease and then turned it on its head and made it its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I kind of felt like.
Yeah, and no, I could totally see that. But
excuse me.
That's okay. But yeah, it definitely was, it had that feel to it, but there's so many, you know, things that you could have said, like you guys said, Romeo and Juliet, West Side Story, I felt a little bit.
Sure.
You know, and yeah. Definitely Grease, you know, the whole different, you know, two different cultures coming together.
And that's why the best part of Crybaby isn't the music and it's not the leads, it's all the interaction between the other characters. Because they are the offbeat, squirrely characters in the background there.
Yes, yes.
Like, how does Tracy Lords get along with Hatchet Face at all? How do those two people become friends ever? You know, it's one of those, what happened here exactly to bond Tracy Lords, Hatchet Face, and Ricky Lake's character together? How did that occur exactly?
Huh. And I don't think we can emphasize enough how big this was for acceptance for Tracy Lords.
Oh, like, it's huge.
Like, huge. Yeah, this complete, not, I don't want to say turned her career around. I mean, it made her career, really.
Well, I mean, she was infamous before she got this role.
She was infamous, but not hireable. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this made her completely hireable, and she went on to, you know, great success because of this, because someone took a chance on her.
Well, exactly.
About Tracy Lords, do we need to talk about Tracy Lords?
I don't think so.
What made her so popular? No.
I think everybody knows.
Go to the Wikipedias, kids.
Well, other than her being underage when she first started.
Yes. I would say you can Google it, but not at work. Not at work. And in some cases, not at home. Like
when the wife's around,
Yeah, because there's certain stuff that could get you on certain lists.
It's true. Yes. Very, very true.
Well, there was an interesting quote I did run across from Tracy Lords at like the 25th or something screening they were doing, that almost all the stars in the movie were just desperate to get attention because they were all trying to break out or change their past or strike something for themselves. And it was interesting from that perspective and hearing from her and then how the leads have gone on.
Well, yeah, Depp was on his way of being typecast. I mean, really.
Oh, yeah.
And so this and then Edward Scissorhands coming out and then his relationship with Burton, you know, those two have been together as actor director ever since, practically.
Pretty much.
So, you know, it helped his career immensely to break out of the hot young teen stud, you know, just to be quirky enough.
Well, and
this was close enough that he looked the part because he could. And John Waters probably knew, he can play this. And if I can get everyone else around him to play what I want them to play, then it will probably come together. So,
yeah, that's why I don't want to be too hard on Johnny for this, because certainly early on in his career, I really was excited by the roles he was taking because they were against type. They were different. They were not what you would normally think of, you know, to make your career. You know, he was working with these really quirky directors. He was going for parts that were against type. He was really trying to put himself out there as like, I'm not just going to be the action hero that you guys know me from TV. I'm not just going to take that and do it to death. He's going to try to do different things, and he's going to try to reinvent himself with every role. At least that's what he was doing, like, the first, I would say, 10 years of his career. And then it kind of all became
Captain pirates.
Pirate
well, it became goth, that. And then it became pirates. So there you go. I mean, but it pays the bills, right? So
sure.
The important part of typecasting is the word
cast. And I still think he does take a lot of chances.
Oh, yeah.
Disney, there's a famous thing about the Disney execs coming on set for the first Pirates of the Caribbean. And they were wondering why Johnny Depp was playing Captain Jack as a gay drunkard. And look at the most popular Disney character they've had in some time.
Yeah.
Or else we wouldn't have, like, what, the sixth movie?
Yo ho ho.
Pirates life for me.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's been a lot of Pirates movies, but there's never been one without him.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
Well, there's still more gold at the bottom of that sea.
Yes, there are. There's a lot of gold in that ocean. It's all cursed, though, so careful. Undead monkeys. Ugh, scary.
Exactly.
So that's, I know you're probably asking, so what does this have to do with gay people? hello, it's Divine and John Waters. What more do you want from me? This is the second of the trilogy of John Waters, who is one of our amazing directors and filmmakers. And we'll be moving on to do the third installment in a few months, whenever Mike wants to schedule it. And then we'll close out John Waters, and we'll go to something even gayer.
Whoa. No way.
I think it's important to note that, you know, just because he's gay doesn't mean that he wears it on his sleeve all the time. I mean, certainly the fact that he doesn't draw attention to it in these movies, these big movies, he's talking about other issues. But yeah, it's there, of course. It's always going to be there. But that's not what all his stuff is about.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's a gay character in Crybaby at all.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on any of them.
You know, but it's a gay sensibility.
Yes. Yeah, very well said. Yes.
And that's the difference there. A movie doesn't have to have a gay character to be gay.
Oh, no, not at all.
Shocking.
I know. Well, Darren, thank you, of course, once again.
You're welcome, Mikes.
And let's wrap up the segment and let's take a quick break. And we'll be back in a minute with the Con Report.
Woohoo!
Hi, this is Michelle with the Iconic Rock Talk Show, and I've talked a lot here about super deluxe box sets. It's kind of a running joke. A lot of them are very worthwhile, have a lot of extras that fans want. Sometimes the extras are padding, and we're starting to see, with the price points on some of these sets being what they are, we're starting to see backlash from fans about these box sets. Queen puts a lot of product into the marketplace still, and they are releasing News of the World with a bunch of extras, including a completely alternate take of the album with demo track vocals and an extended version of We Will Rock You that no one's ever heard. That one's coming out at around $100, and the response across the internet, even on their fan pages, is overwhelmingly negative. So be interesting to see where the market for the box sets goes over the next year. If prices come down, extras get pared down. But wading into all of this, completely oblivious, with supreme confidence as only he can, Gene Simmons has created the Gene Simmons Vault, 150 tracks dating back to 1966 that he's written but never released, featuring notable rock and roll artists, quote unquote, and of course, Kiss. It's packaged in an actual safe that weighs 38 pounds. It's 10 CDs in a 38-pound safe. You also get a Gene action figure, an oversized commemorative coin, because a regular commemorative coin won't do, a deluxe book with over 50,000 words. He counted the words. And 160 pages of unseen photos and track-by-track commentary and a special gift. You also get it handed to you in a 5-minute meet-and-greet in your town. That costs $2,000. If you want more, $25,000 gets you and a guest an intimate hour with Gene in a studio listening to tracks from the vault, a low-numbered edition, and your name listed as executive producer. $50,000 will get you the home experience, you, Gene, and 25 of your best friends in your house, getting a two-hour songs and stories playback and Q&A session in your own home. If you're interested, GeneSimmonsVault.com. It's going to cost more than $50,000, most likely, but Rolling Stone magazine is up for sale again. The founder, Jan Wenner, sold 49% of his share last June, and now he's putting his controlling stake up, although he and his son, Gus, intend to stay at the magazine. Something else that it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in the next year. And GoldDerby.com, predictors of winners of things like the Oscars and Emmys, they ran a fan poll last week asking what act fans would like to see inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because we are in Hall of Fame season now. The initial winner was the Monkees, but a last-minute surge put Bon Jovi into first place with 35% of the vote from about 4,700 fans. This is very clearly the classic album rock crowd and very testosterone heavy. No women. After Bon Jovi, it was the Monkees, Three Dog Night, Moody Blues, Doobie Brothers, Boston Dire Straits, The Cars, Styx, Commodores, Foreigner, and Steppenwolf. I'm a little surprised Def Leppard's not on the list and that Moody Blues is below Three Dog Night. But we'll see. Personally, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Foreigner, and probably REO Speedwagon. I've never been big on them getting into the Hall of Fame. What they're very, very good at what they do, and I love their songs. But I don't think anything they did really changed music or influenced anyone who turned out to be influential in turn. It's just really good, commercially successful music. But the Hall has been more receptive to bands like that in recent years, so we will see how it goes. Predictions are up at iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com, and on the blog roll you can find links to some other blogs and their predictions for this year's class. That's all for this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Con! Well, we might be still recovering from Dragon Con, but that doesn't mean we are against going to any conventions, especially when one's coming up that's so amazing and fantastic that it's already one of our favorites of the year, and that is Monsterama. And our good friend Anthony Taylor is joining us to tell us all about this year's event.
Hi, guys. Good to be talking with you.
Absolutely, sir. Yes, this is the fourth year for Monsterama. Is that correct?
That is correct. This is our fourth big year. Every
Congratulations.
Year getting better and bigger. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yeah. So yes, let's get into it. Bigger and better. What's happening this year?
Well, we've got an amazing lineup of guests, including Sybil Danning, Barbara Luna, Dick Miller, Daniel Roebuck, and Gene Warren Jr., who I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but he's an Academy Award winner for special effects for Terminator 2, and he's worked on hundreds and hundreds of films and television series and stuff. And some of our favorites are coming back again. Dacre Stoker is going to be back, Lynn Lowry. John Ferris is coming back this year, Mark Maddox, Charles Rutledge, Valentine Wolf. So we've got a lot of cool people coming.
Absolutely. And one of the names that stands out for me, especially after seeing her at Dragon Con, is Kat Hudson. I was not familiar with her, I don't know why, before this year at Dragon Con, but I was looking at her stuff and I was like, wow, she's just a great person too.
She is, but she's a terrifically talented artist, and she's someone that I hooked up with over at MomoCon this year. I saw her stuff, and she just blew me away. So I had asked her to please come and be a guest with us and do our T-shirt design and everything. So she put the art together for us, and we're really happy with the way it turned out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The t-shirts are becoming like a really big thing for you guys. There's like definitely really cool artwork every year.
Well, something thanks.
To look That's, forward to. It's like the yeah. peach tree. It's like the road race.
Right. Exactly. Come down here and run with us and get a free t-shirt. Except they're not quite free, you know.
And there won't be a lot of running involved, really.
No, no. You can literally walk.
Well, awesome. Well, you guys are in a different hotel this year, correct?
Yep. Yeah, we moved away from the Perimeter Center Marriott up to the Alpharetta Marriott, which is right at 400 and Windward Parkway, literally right at the bottom of the exit. You're looking at the hotel if okay. you're going north. So very easy to find and right next to the highway there. And awesome. We got a great rate of $89 a night this year, which is $10 less than it was for us for the last 2 years.
That's fantastic. Staying anywhere in the metro area, that's still amazing.
I think so, too. And it's a very neat hotel. It's I was not familiar with it until we went out to take a look at it. But the facility is just about exactly the right size for us, and it's laid out very nicely. And I think everybody's going to be pretty happy with it.
So I noticed that you've got quite a number of events, really special events too. One of the things that caught my eye was the live musical score with showing the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
That's right. Last year we did it with Nosferatu, and the folks at Valentine Wolf provided an original musical score played live accompanying the film. And we're doing it this year with Caligari, which we're very, very excited about.
That is really cool. It just shows like, yeah, these are the kind of things that I love about Monsterama, because it's a celebration of classic horror film, classic film, and the craft of it, you know?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we've got three different panels for programming, which are our main programming, which encompasses a lot of our guests. And then a literary sci-fi and art program, that covers literary sci-fi, art, and comics. And we've got our maker programming panels, which are demos of makeup and prop making and all kinds of different crafts and things like that. So we do try and kind of look at a lot of different aspects of what we're celebrating.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I noticed this year, too, and I don't know if you've done this before and I just didn't notice, but you've got the model kit contest.
This will be our third year with the model kit contest. Actually.
Very nice. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, and that gets big every year. We have some really cool prizes, and it's always neat to see what people put together and bring in.
And of course, I would imagine that you're doing some sort of costume contest over the weekend as well.
Well, you know what? We're not about competition. You know,
okay,
we're too laid back for that.
Gotcha.
So we like to have people come in costume and just have fun and celebrate the costumes they're wearing. We do have a Saturday night, our Monster Prom, which everybody's welcome to dress up in any fashion that they'd like to and come, be it cosplay or formal wear or pajamas or just whatever. And as long as you got clothes on. And we tend to get a lot of people in costume around that and around Saturday and Sunday, just walking around the floor of the convention, actually.
Very nice. Yes, the Monster Prom is the big nighttime event on Saturday night, and got an 80s feel to it this year?
We do, yeah. We've got DJ Death's Kiss is going to come and run a bunch of 80s and goth and classic monster sounds for us. For everybody to dance. And of course, we'll have a lot of great prizes to give away like we always have in the past.
Awesome. Awesome. What other, any sort of other events that you guys going on of note?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've got Cineprov riffing on Irwin Allen's version of The Lost World on Friday night.
Very cool.
Absolutely. And then following that, we'll have a screening of Space Base from Outer Space, which will have director and writer Brian K. Williams there, and stars Ellie Church and Allison Meyer will be there as well. Allison's going to be with us the whole weekend, and Ellie is only going to be there for the screening. So if you want to meet her, you got to come Friday night. And then on Saturday after the Monster Prom, we've got a pajama party screening of Vampire Lovers. And then the afternoon, we've got the Silver Screen Spook Show, which this year is going to be one with a film that features our guest of honor, Dick Williams, which is I can't remember the name of it right now. Sorry.
That's okay. That's
I've got so much going on right now. It's kind of crazy trying to keep everything in my head, you know.
No, I mean,
it's Terror. Sorry, it's called The Terror with Dick Miller.
Gotcha. I was gonna say, you know. Yes, absolutely. Spook Show, like, that's enough said right there. It doesn't, you know.
Right, right. Then on Sunday, we've got the Atlanta Radio Theater Company are going to do a live version of The Brides of Dracula.
Oh, which very is nice.
Very cool. Yeah, so it's a live audio adventure with actors, sound effects, everything.
Wow. Is that an original piece, do you know? Or is that like something that's, I don't know where they're reading that from. Is that a classic thing?
Not sure. We'll figure it out, though.
Absolutely. I'm curious about it. So, yes, I'm definitely looking forward to this. Unfortunately, last year, I was so sick, I couldn't attend it, and it killed me. It really did.
It literally did almost kill you, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
I know you really wanted to be there, and then Friday, you were, like, way out of it.
Yeah, that's how bad I was off, because it had to be something that bad to keep me from there. So, but I'm looking forward to making up for lost time this weekend, and I encourage everybody else to do so. Of course, you can find out all the information at MonsteramaCon.com, correct?
That is correct.
And I was going to say, you've got great Facebook. You do Instagram very well too. I follow you on Instagram and I see all that stuff, and that's pretty cool.
Very good. We like to try and keep up with all the social media as best we can.
And what's really fun too is that when you follow Monsterama and when you follow the group and the page and everything, you're not just getting constant promos for what's going to happen at the con. Of course, you're getting all the latest news, but you're also getting all this stuff about what's happening in the world of horror movies right now, and just little fun things that happen. It's really kind of a cool social media site to watch.
Well, thanks. We put a lot of time and care into doing that. We want to make sure that people are getting, you know, something that's really worth them tuning in for, and not just a bunch of crummy commercials. Because, you know, nobody likes that. Nobody has time for that. So, yeah, we like to put up funny memes and interesting facts and news and this, that, and the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's reflected of the attitude that you guys have online is the exact same attitude that people will find at the show. So it goes hand in hand, and it just makes a great community that way. So.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, that's what we're going for. We're all here just to have fun, you know.
Absolutely. So so Marriott Alpharetta, and that is September 29th through October 1st. Perfect way to spring off if you haven't already, the Halloween season is to embrace Monsterama. Tickets, I assume, are still available online.
They are, I think, probably by the time this airs, they will be offline because we have to get them ready, you know, the week of the show.
Sure, gotcha.
But they will be available at the door, and we have 3-day passes or single day passes, whatever anybody wants. We'll make sure you get in with how you want to get in.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, I am looking forward to it. I hope to see all our listeners there as well to say howdy, and we will see you there for sure.
Absolutely, I'll be hard to miss. Thanks again, and are you guys going to do a podcast from the show?
We would love to do that. Yes,
very good.
We would definitely love to do that, and we will reveal that, I guess, later on. But yeah, definitely all about that.
Look forward to seeing you.
Absolutely, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
So yes, we are very excited to be a part of Monsterama and to attend Monsterama. And yes, stay tuned. Hopefully in the next week or so, we'll let you know what our specific panel that we'll be doing will be. And for those who won't make it, we will try to record it for you and bring some of Monsterama to you guys, especially in October, which is our countdown to Halloween, which is going to be very exciting. Before we get to, there's not a lot of other shows and conventions that we're going to be attending, or even the other ESO folks are attending this year. I think the only one of note is in November, the 24th through the 26th, Chicago TARDIS. Nathan Laws from the 42 cast will be there. So you can say howdy to Nathan at the Chicago TARDIS. And that's a great show. As far as a Doctor Who fan, I was there a few years ago, and that's one of the better Doctor Who conventions. Not that I've been to a bad one, but Chicago TARDIS has been doing it for a while, and they have a great history there and a great community of Doctor Who fans there. So it's a great way to spend Thanksgiving weekend. But speaking of ways to spend a great weekend, I do wanted to give a shout out and mention to an event that I was at this past weekend, which was Japan Fest right here in Atlanta, Japan Fest Atlanta. Japan Fest has been going on in the Atlanta area for about, my understanding is it's been going on for about 30 years, which is a long time. I was like, wow, I didn't know it had that kind of history. And it usually happens, you know, in the fall, is September. And now it's taking place at the Infinite Energy Center, which is next to the Infinite Energy Arena, I think, right? Where the hockey team plays, right?
The Atlanta Gladiators.
Yes, the Gladiators, right. So it's right next to that. It's in the convention center. And basically it's 2 days of just celebrating all things Japanese, whether it's Japanese food. It's got a lot of vendor booths, some anime manga represented, a lot of Japanese toys and kachikis, that kind of thing. They've also got plenty of workshops and displays. What drew me there this year in particular was performance. They have a number of performers performing all sorts of Japanese style music and dance and even karate and martial arts. I was there to see my good friend Marina perform as part of Ronin Taiko. I hope I pronounced that right. Taiko. It's a T-A-I-K-O. And it's her and her husband, Roy. They are drum performers, Japanese drum performers. He's been doing it for 18 years, and he's actually studied in Japan. And it's just an amazing thing to see. So I was there to support them, but I was blown away by their performance. And I think a lot of other people were too. This is the first time that they've performed in at Japan Fest in Atlanta. And from what I gathered from the crowd, as well as some of the organizers, they are keen to have them back next year as well. So that'll be very cool. So, I saw some good friends of the station there, Nikki Rao Baker, fresh off her own visit to Japan. Was there. I ran into her in the parking lot, right, before we even entered. Also, Kirby from our good friend does a lot of ESO and does the ESO Books Club with us. He was in attendance. And a lot of other friends of the show were there, too. It's a great vibe. It's, like I said, a celebration of all things Japan. Had some good food, had some bubble tea, and saw some great performances. And it's really cheap. It's only $10 to get in for adults. And the parking is free because it's at the Gwinnett Center. And it's a great, great, great afternoon. I definitely am looking forward to going next year. This started in 1987. So it's actually an anniversary next year. Now this year is an anniversary year for them. That's amazing. I definitely encourage people to check it out. So if you have not been to Japan Fest in Atlanta, definitely add it to your schedule. Find out when it's going to be next year. And, it's definitely worth it. You can bring the whole family too. There's a lot of activities for kids of all ages, and it's a good time. Have you ever been to Japan Fest, Mike?
I have not. It sounds amazing, though, and the pictures you posted looked wonderful.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun taking pictures, especially of Ronin Taiko performing, and some other stuff, too. There, and in fact, they had a couple of people playing Japanese, I don't know what they're called, but the Japanese guitars, kind of like, it sounded like they were doing the soundtrack to Kubo and the Two Strings. So in fact, I actually, when we were watching them, I actually whispered to Michelle, I said, if you must blink, do it now. Great stuff. I definitely had a great time, and it's a great event. So I definitely encourage people to go check it out next year, Japan Fest 2017 or 2018 next year, of course. Check that out on social media. They've got some pages there. I'll put a link in the show notes as well. So Maybe even ESO can have a presence at Japan Fest next year in a greater number. That would be awesome.
You never know.
And so if you guys have an event that you've been to, a convention coming up that you want to rave about, please feel free to reach out to us because we love talking about conventions and events of all kinds.
Take. I'm your host, Angela, and this week, This Geek Girl is talking about the new Tick television series. Now, I'm a huge fan of the Tick cartoon live-action series and the comics, so when I heard that a new Tick series was being made for Amazon Prime, I was super excited. I was also really, really excited when I saw the really cool pop-up at San Diego Comic-Con, and then was really sad when I couldn't walk through it because it was always open while I was working. And even more sad when I saw those really cute little Tick headbands that they were giving out if you walked through it. Now, for anyone who has seen the Tick, Patrick Warburton is pretty much your headcanon for the character. So I was really interested to see how the show, without him playing the Tick, would go. And let me say, it goes amazingly. This show is so much fun and so good, and the casting is actually really, really good as well. Now, it is a short season for season one, but it has the Tick feel to it. It's action-packed, it's fun, it has great humor, the characters are very comic bookish, and by the end of the season, it really leaves you wanting more. Also, it warmed my heart to see that Patrick Warburton was a producer on the show. I'm really, really excited to see what characters we'll get later on as well, once they keep making seasons. If you have Amazon Prime, then you should watch this show, like, right now. If you don't, sign up for a free trial and watch it. Just seriously, stop everything you're doing and go watch this show. Thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station One podcast. I want to thank, of course, Darren.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You are always welcome on the show.
I'm going to add some more fringe to the station now.
Oh, great.
Blue and orange, I think. Lovely.
Just don't let them plug in the lights.
Oh, no.
What?
You're adding the DJ machine, aren't you, Elsa?
Always.
Of course. Of course.
Lights plus sound.
And a mirror ball.
My head hurts.
Well, that without saying, I thought. So.
Well, I'm getting that headache again. Gee, it always happens at the end of these episodes. I don't know why. I really don't know why how that happens. So, Darren, where can people find you?
They can find me at legionofsubstitutepodcasters.com, where we talk about the legion-y goodness that's out there.
That's right.
Of which there's not a lot right now, but we still talk anyway.
Well, it's actually, I'm impressed you guys have kept on going with no legion.
Yeah, we keep going. But there's like 40 years of comics to cover.
That's true.
I mean, we've got a lot of backlog to get through, so hopefully when DC decides to start publishing Legion again, we'll pay attention and we'll read it, and hopefully it will be great. We're waiting for the most excellent book ever.
Aha!
We'll see.
Keep your fingers crossed. DC's been teasing, so hopefully they will.
They keep teasing. I'm over the teasing. I am done with being teased. When they want to publish a book, we'll talk.
Okay.
I'm not buying a $4.99 tome for a panel of a Legionnaire. Sorry. Not happening.
No, or someone breathing on a piece of glass and typing in the Legion logo or something.
Putting their L there, really.
Exactly.
I can go on the internet and swipe that piece of artwork if I need to. I don't think so. No.
No. Understandable. And Michael, thank you so much.
But of course, thank you for having me.
And, you know, I guess we'll talk to you next time, too.
Probably.
Most likely. I'm a captive audience for Darren, usually, so.
That's what he says about a lot of people, so it's okay.
Shh, don't give away my secrets, Faber.
Oh, okay. And Mr. Gordon.
As always, it's my pleasure.
Anything you're going to shout out about real quick?
I do. I have to shout out to another podcast here on the ESO Network. I had the good fortune to join the boys at the Ear Station DCU, speaking of DC stuff. Mm-hmm. We talked about the 25th anniversary of Batman the Animated Series. So Drew and Cletus and myself, as well as the award-winning author Bobby Nash. We're on there to talk all about Batman the Animated Series, what we liked and why it was so influential and why it's still probably one of the best cartoons that's ever been made. So
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Check that out. It's and that's coming from a guy, and Legion never appeared in Batman the Animated Series. So if he's saying, if Darren's saying it's, that, that's something.
It's an excellent series. Very well done.
So good. So yeah, check that out. It's in the newest episode.
That is awesome. For me, I guess my shout out real quick is, of course, going to David Lynch. You know, Judy and I are watching Twin Peaks series, you know, the third series of it, and we're on episode 8. And, you know, I'll give reports every once in a while. I just don't know what I watched last night, and my head still hurts from it. And it was a lot of fun. There's a lot of great feel to the whole series. And just last night's was like, man, I haven't felt like this since I did LSD in college. So,
wow.
So it was pretty amazing. And good on you, David. I just wanted to say that real quick. And if you get a chance, because I know they've announced that Twin Peaks is coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, you'll be able to order it through our Amazon site. And, you know, of course, you know, check it out, and maybe they'll give you a blow-by-blow, episode-by-episode guide of what the heck is going on the show.
That would spoil the fun.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. So, of course, join us again next week when we are going back to the movies already. That's right, folks. Kingsman, The Golden Circle is coming out. It is going to be interesting to see what happens with Eggsy and all the rest of the Kingsmen. And I'm just looking forward to it. I loved the first one. It was a sleeper because I didn't expect it to be as enjoyable. So it'll be tons of fun, and we will be back then. But until then, my name is Mike Faber, and we will see you here next time on the Air Station One podcast. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness, and if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station One podcast. Peace.
You can't stop in avalanches. It races down the hill. You can try to stop the seasons, girl, but you know you never will.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.